Folks, welcome back to Beer and Business. Today on the show, an American patriot, Steve Ankerstar. 20 years in the Air Force, Darren, as a fighter pilot. He flew the F-15 Eagle and the F-117 stealth fighter.
It's amazing. But you know what else he's done?
What?
He's a financial advisor.
Oh, yeah. That's why we had him on the show.
Oh, yeah.
I actually had an amazing conversation with him. We talked about everything from what it takes to be an entrepreneur to how to build wealth with your money and
somebody else's.
Yes. This was an unbelievable conversation with a true American patriot. We hope you love this as much as we did. Folks, it's Steve Ankerstar.
Welcome to Beer and Business. You found the best podcast for entrepreneurs. We serve crafty business knowledge, comedy, and yes, beer. And now it's time for our hosts. If he were to pat you on the back, you'd list it on your resume. It's Jake Mullins. And his beer never gets warm. It just sits there, staying frosty, waiting for him. Mr. John Winnie. And if you spell his name in Scrabble, you automatically win. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Darren Flanagan.
Steve Ankerstar, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much, Jake. Appreciate it.
So I first of all got to say, we're going to get into Steve's story, but his last name is Ankerstar and he has a podcast. How freaking cool is that?
Oh, that is. It's better than Anchorman, I hope.
Yes, definitely.
He wears a different color suit than Ron Burgundy.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
So first of all, Steve, we are remote. So you're coming to us from Austin, Texas, right?
You bet.
Well, I am so sorry that you couldn't be here in the studio today. So we always get excited about podcast day, but today was a really special day because sometimes we get excited about not only conversation, but the beer.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew it was coming. So today, Lion Creek is launching a new beer called 6 Foot Rule. You know, the social distancing, you need your 6 feet.
Oh, well, nice. Yeah.
This beer actually was developed as a mistake from all of the COVID madness and some beer was sitting in a tank. And long story short, they came up with this hazy New England style IPA that I am so excited to try.
It's awesome.
Come on, let's give this a little drink, Darren.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. I think that's the best beer I've ever had from Lion Creek.
Oh, wow. Hot
that damn. Is absolute perfection.
Oh, they lowered it, too. It's 6.3.
Oh, so it's a session beer.
Yep. High session beer.
Juicy, tropical, hazy. This is a really proper New England IPA. Oh, my gosh. I've been looking forward to trying this all freaking day.
You've had this one before, actually.
I did?
Way back when. Before they switched their canning now because they intentionally made it this time. Last time they were fixing one and we had it. It was the Big Tall Boys. It was a 16 ounces and it was just a silver can with the white label on it.
Oh,
6 foot rule. We tried it because you could only buy it back then at Lion Creek. And now you could buy this out of the store.
This tastes better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think they've done something to refine it.
Perfected it.
Yeah, this is really, really good.
Please keep making this one.
Yeah, Spencer, please. I'll do anything. And Steve, I know you've cracked a beer.
I did, yeah. I wouldn't feel right not having a beer open for this podcast. So I'm drinking the Thirsty Goat, which, you know, we have a lot of cool beers here in Austin. It's brewed right here and it's very popular. It's from the Thirsty Planet Brewing Company.
Oh.
6.8% on my end.
Oh, so you're drinking a session beer too.
Yeah.
That line keeps moving.
That's right.
Yeah, Austin's got a really cool beer scene.
Yeah, I've never been
to Austin. And that's what I mean. Shout out to all your listeners that, you know, if you haven't been to Austin, put it on your list. It's a great place to come visit and have all kinds of beers.
It really is. So, Steve, I first of all want to start off by thanking you for your service.
Appreciate that.
Steve had one of the coolest jobs in the entire world, except maybe for podcasting with Darren Flanagan. That's really. Oh, shoot. Who was that? Was that me?
Nope, that was me. I'll be fixing that on my end.
Okay, cool. So Steve was a fighter pilot.
Oh, in the good branch of the service? I mean, they're all good branches, but like
what the hell is that supposed to mean?
The best branch of the service.
I don't know. I guess that's a.
Which one, Steve? Which branch?
Well, I will say the best branch, but I'm a little biased there. I was in the Air Force.
See, there you go.
So, Steve, you flew the F-15 Eagle, and then you graduated to the F-117 Stealth Fighter. Is that right?
I did. Yeah. I flew one tour in the F-15 Eagle. And then in order to go to the F-117, you have to be an experienced fighter pilot, which what that means is 500 hours of flight time, which what that means to you guys is about 3 years of experience. So once you've been flying about any fighter in the Air Force for 3 years, then you're eligible to go to the F-117 and then fly mostly at night.
That has got to be an amazing experience.
Wow.
Yeah. Absolutely. So you you spend half your, instead of being on a normal day schedule like everybody's used to, you know, we're going home at midnight, sleeping around, you know, till around 10 in the morning or so by the time you get to bed the night prior, and you're on a night schedule for 10 months out of the year. So a little weird.
I would totally do it to fly one of those things. That'd be pretty awesome. So I got to ask you, because I think fighter pilot's one of the coolest jobs in the world. So was this something that you had always wanted to do, or did you enter the service and kind of work your way into? How did that happen for you?
Well, my dad was Air Force, so I did follow, and he retired when I was in third grade. So I can't really say that I remember him being in the Air Force other than I remember a lot of pictures of him in uniform. But as I kind of grew up, I was an only child, really liked math and science. So kind of thought, well, maybe I'll be an engineer. And then my junior year in high school, I went to the movies with one of my best friends and saw a pretty cheesy movie when looking back. But at the time, it was epic. And that was Top Gun.
Hey, yep.
So I saw that. I walked out of the theater. And I turned to my buddy. And I said, that's what I'm going to do with my life. And he laughed. I went home, told my parents, and they kind of laughed, even though my dad was in the Air Force. He didn't fly, and he knew a couple of fighter pilots along the way. And he's like, well, son, I hope that works out, but let's just talk about plan B, just in case you don't have to make it all the way into flying fighters. So I said, okay. And it took a while, but I finally got there out of college and got to fly for a better part of 20 years. So what a privilege. And when people thank me for my service, I'm always polite about it, but it's true. I did have one of the best jobs in the military. So it's kind of like I thank the taxpayer for letting me do all that, because I spent quite a bit of taxpayer money over the years flying around.
Look who's laughing now.
Some people would say he is one cool MF.
So I just indulge me, Steve, because I'm a huge aviation buff.
Right now he's got the biggest shit-eating grin on his face, Steve, if you could see it.
No, and I'm a pilot too, a private pilot, but
yeah, there's a difference.
It's a huge freaking difference. Time.
Like millions of dollars.
I flew lawnmowers with wings. I mean, come on. But, you know, clearly you start off with your training. What was it like the first time you got into a fighter jet?
Well, you spend about a year going through a basic pilot training for the Air Force, and you fly a prop job for the first 6 months of that. Now you do. Back in my day, it was a jet, but you fly 6 months and really just learn kind of the basics of formation flying, aerobatic flying, that sort of thing. And then you fly a jet fighter trainer, the T-38, which is quite a bit more difficult to fly. And that's where the career field kind of sorts itself out. And, you know, almost anybody can fly an airplane if you teach them right. And then a few others can go upside down in an airplane. A few others can go upside down and go really fast. And you sort of keeps the screening people out along the way. And if you get to the end, you get to fly a fighter. And it's about after you do your year of training, you get your wings, and you go through a fighter training lead-in, which is another couple months, and then you actually get to the fighter. And when you step out to the fighter for the first time, it's and you're mentally ready for it at the time. Well, you're supposed to be mentally ready for it. You look at it, and it's kind of like this is this man-machine competition. Because you have this amazing machine that can go super fast, has all this power, and you look at it and you're like, okay, buddy. And you know, in single seat, so you have to kind of have an agreement. It's like riding a horse. It's like, okay, look, you got to let me be in charge a little bit today. we're going to go fly around some here, and I would like to be in charge for, you know, a small portion of that. And then, once you take off in it the first time, everything's happening so fast. That you can process it, but you're not any good at it. You're just barely hanging on. And then you do that. The brain is an amazing thing. The fourth ride in the F-15 is solo. So the first three, you have an instructor in the back to save you. And then the fourth one, you're out there on your own and pretty much on your own for the rest of your career after that. So it's a lot of learning really fast, but we have the right people that make it through all the hoops to get to do that.
So what was it like when you got the authorization to fly the F-117?
Well, I was I was torn because my first assignment was flying Eagles in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. So think of this lifestyle. So single, had a beach house. Lived in the bay on the north side of the Destin area. If you make it down to that area, it's not a bad place to be.
Nope.
Or live. And I'm flying out over the Gulf in a fast jet, doing a lot of turning and burning. So it was a pretty good lifestyle. And at that time, it was my late 20s. And, you know, I'd considered, okay, when you're in the Air Force, especially flying fighters, you tend to say things like, I'm married to the Air Force first or married to my airplane. And that's largely true because you're working long hours to stay combat ready, you know, in case your number gets called to go do something for real. But it was a good place to also enjoy your life on the beach there. And when I got the F-117 assignment, I did want it because I applied for it and got it. And the bad part about it was here I was just getting ready to turn 30, and I had to leave Fort Walton Beach, Florida, and go to Alamogordo, New Mexico, which is kind of not the same.
It's really dry and desolate, I believe, isn't it?
It was, and there's a lot of folks who don't consider there's a lot of boot marks, people getting drugged to Alamogordo. So it's an amazing plane and an absolute privilege to get to fly and a program to be a part of, and I got to do amazing things into it. But the weird thing of how life works is I got there and I checked in. And the first day when I checked in, I met the girl that is now my wife with two kids. So of all things, here I was living on the beach and living a great life in Florida. I was dreading going to New Mexico because I thought my single years, my early 30s years would largely be wasted because I would be in the middle of nowhere. And I met my to-be wife the first day. So things happen for a reason.
Well, the big guy upstairs said, if there's any chance of getting this guy to settle down, as my plan is, I got to get him away from this lifestyle. Because exactly. It is not going to happen here.
And the rest part of that story was, you know, before he gets, big, fat and ugly, you better get him a wife while he's still in fighting shape. So
That's right. So how long were you in the service?
I was in 20 years. So I did a full basically career and then retired into the retired reserve. So we're technically still on call till we're, 60 or something. But fully retired, would not be answering any phone that said Air Force on it if they wanted to try to call me back. So happily into my second career.
Very cool. So when you left the Air Force, did you know what you wanted to do? Or was it one of those things where it's like retire and then, okay, let the dust settle and try to figure it out?
Well, one of the things that I've actually benefited from in my life is having a pretty clear vision of things. And I think that if you would look across the board to successful folks in whatever field it is, they've had a very clear vision of what life would look like. And then that way, if you have that clear vision, then it's easier to do all the steps that would get you to achieving that vision. So if we back it all the way up to high school, before I saw Top Gun, and depending on how old you are, you may or may not recognize the show, but there was a show on TV called Family Ties.
Yep.
With Michael J. Fox. He was Alex Keaton, the nerdiest kid in school, carried a Wall Street Journal around in a briefcase. Yes. About a terrible role model as far as being cool. But I enjoyed the show, and I really was interested in investing at an early age. So part of it was that show kind of glorified what being an investing guy would be like. And I also had an insurance agent that lived right down the road from me. And he kind of showed me the time value of money chart when I was in eighth grade. He said, you know, if you save $250 now and, you know, through all the standard stuff you hear from financial guys. And I was like, really? That's all I have to do is start saving and investing now. And I'll be a millionaire in my 40s. I'm like, I kind of like that. So I really wanted to get into investing. Until, you know, a couple of years later when I saw Top Gun and I said, I can invest when I'm in my 40s. I want to fly fighters if I'm so-called, you know, good enough and able to make it through all the hoops to get to do that. I definitely want to do that first. So I did have a clear vision of towards the end of my military career that I wanted to get out and start my own investment firm and, you know, write a book and start a podcast. So it was kind of all there for me. I just had to finally get the time to be able to do all that stuff.
Well, that's really cool. So you have your investment firm now. How many years have you been in business with your firm?
6 years now. And of course, the firm, my wife likes to tease me, and we have a pretty good sense of humor. Most fighter pilots and their families do. But I called it Afterburner Financial, and it's just a sign that I couldn't let go, right? Of the
I love that.
So I'm sitting here in a black flight suit right now. So it looks like I'm getting ready to go hop in a fast jet and go flying when unfortunately that's not going to happen again. But yeah, carried my my fighter pilot background with me into my own career. So about 6 years now.
Yeah. And so as I understand it, like when you do your podcast and when you do interviews and that sort of thing, you're typically always wearing the flight suit, right?
I do. And it's really started out when I left active duty. You know, some people and this is personal opinion. You'll see something. We have a big election coming up and not going down that road to politics. But
come on. You know you want to talk about me, Steve.
You will see some folks that use their rank, you know, to kind of help market themselves. Well, I was kind of against that. So I've always been against folks using military rank for their own purpose. So I was like, okay, well, I liked wearing a flight suit, but I don't want to run around with my rank on it.
You don't believe in RHIP?
Right. Well, I wanted to earn my way in instead of people just seeing the rank and saying, oh, okay, he must be good. So I bought a black flight suit with no rank on it and started speaking. And I've always enjoyed speaking to groups and especially youth groups. And would basically give back to the taxpayers by, you know, if anybody wanted to hear a cool flying story, it's like, I've got one for you. And they're like, yeah, come on in. So that's kind of where it started with it as a speaking outfit. And I've just kept it now to where I've worn it so much, it's almost the expectation.
Do you wash it ever?
I do. Okay. I do. Just like anything else, it doesn't get better with time.
Only Darren Flanagan would ask a question like that, just so we're clear.
I mean, you know, you play sports and you're on a hot streak. You don't change anything, right? You don't wash your socks. You don't wash your... So I'm just wondering if you've been on a hot streak since you've been wearing this thing, why wash it?
That's you, Darren. That's not normal people.
Well, he's a financial if he's a financial investor or planner for folks,
it's a conversation starter. Probably, he doesn't want to stink the
room. I know,
room
but
up
I mean,
he
if
in.
He was wearing it successfully when we were in a bull market and he washed it, and then all of a sudden we go to a bear market, it's like it's Steve's fault. He washed the flight.
Do you wash
all the time?
Okay.
So anyway,
so Steve,
enough of that.
I actually really like that because it's one of the things that we really believed in when we started doing our networking events, which 2020 has put a big kibosh on. But we do our events at breweries, and Line Creek Brewing has been a great partner of the show. And it's one of those things where the biggest thing is if you're having a beer, like that icebreaker, that conversation starter is so much easier. And that's important in business to kind of break people down and just have a conversation without our guards up.
Yeah, I agree. When I go to networking events, which I had to do initially, we moved to Texas and we really didn't know anybody here. And I mean, I always know somebody somewhere because the military is like that, but I didn't know a lot of people. So I had to do things like go out to networking events and I would just wear the flight suit. And just like going to an air show, you walk in a flight suit when everybody else is in, you know, something else, or, you know, networking events where everybody's kind of dressed up and you just stand there for about 5 minutes and then pretty soon somebody's going to come up and go, so are you a pilot? And there you go. Pretty soon you have a crowd around you and the 2 hour event's gone by and you've been able to meet a whole bunch of cool people.
So I have to stop and bite right here. Do you have any cool flight stories you can tell us?
Well, I do.
Come on, give us a good one.
I don't want to, you know, it might take some time, but I'll
give you a short one.
Oh, come on. Give us one. Our audience needs this.
A quick one is it's 2002. So 9/11 had happened and, you know, everybody was kind of amped up to go off to war. And during that time, we had done a lot of training. And of course, we do a lot of air shows to pay, you know, pay the taxpayers back, show them, you know, what they're paying for and let them, you know, build confidence that they have the right people that are ready to go to war for them and avenge, you know, the 9/11 event. Well, I was down in Miramar in Florida and it was a Friday afternoon and the Blue Angels were flying in and they landed. And when they landed, one of our guys knew one of them. So we all went over there and they mentioned, they're like, hey, we're supposed to fly over game one of the World Series tomorrow. And they're like, you know, we're going to cancel because we can't see a six ship formation going into the sun. It was at Anaheim when Anaheim was playing San Francisco. And it's pointed the way that stadium's oriented. Is they're flying right into the sun. So they weren't legal to fly in close formation there. And they don't do anything single ship. So they're like, hey, do you guys want to do it? And my buddy and I kind of looked at each other like, well, yeah.
Duh.
Made a bunch of phone calls that night to all the way up to DC to get approval. And the next night, within, you know, less than 24 hours notice, I flew over game one of the World Series over Anaheim Stadium. And it was I've flown in combat. I've dropped bombs. I flew the shock and awe campaign. I've flown some high visibility events. But as far as the most pressure being on you, when you fly and have to meet an exact time at the end of the national anthem in front of millions, you know, of people watching on TV, that's a lot of pressure. So fortunately it went beautifully and it was a great experience.
How many times did you look down at the watch when you were flying straight?
Well, what is weird is you couldn't see crap out there. So quite a bit. So, you know, it's the fighter pilot standard, right? So when these guys are like, we can't do this, we have to cancel. They're like, can you do it? And of course, the initial bravado is like, well, hell yeah, I can. We get all the approvals to do it. And we looked at each other and we kind of made a deal. So I got to go first. And then I'm flying up there like, oh, this is going to be easy because I have the chart and, you know, I'm high, you know, expensive navigation gear. It's like, come on, how hard is it? I'm like, well, except you can't see. And when you do a flyby, normally you're under control when you're in a busy area like Anaheim, you know, from being, if you've done any IFR flying, you don't get to just do what you want.
Sure.
But when you line up for a stadium, within about 10 miles of that stadium, they make a corridor for you. So the blimp and all the helicopters that are normally over the stadium, about a minute prior, that's literally the coordination you have. They make this kind of gap for you to fly through. And then you line up basically second base with home plate. And then that's the angle. And then once you're done, then you kind of peel off and you're back under control again. And I didn't really think about how much you really couldn't see until I was flying down I-5, where I could look down and see I-5. And I knew the building that I was going to hook a right at. And I turned, I was like, okay, that's the building. So I turned right around that building and lined up. And it's like, I saw the stadium with a sensor I have in my airplane. It's an infrared sensor. So that picked up the stadium easy, but I looked out and I couldn't see it with my eyes. So I'm actually looking down in the cockpit until about 20 seconds prior. And it was when I actually look outside and then I could see the stadium through the, you know, it's right at sunset with a bunch of haze in the air. So it was interesting how, it was looking at the watch quite a bit, making sure I was on time that whole time. And of course, you're talking to somebody that's in the stadium for all that coordination, making sure everything goes perfect.
Man, that's so cool.
Oof.
I thought we were going to hear like a war story, but that's like totally bitching, man. Game one of the World Series.
That just got me all clenched up. I was like, oh, that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
The war stories are a little bit longer. So that's why I like telling the air show stories. But the flyby stories, whenever you see, and of course, hopefully we all return to sports here soon and we get to do flybys. But when you see a flyby, there's always a person standing right by the camera person that has the camera on the national anthem singer. So if you think of that orchestration, so that camera person, so is what, 6, 8, 10 feet in front of the singer, and you talk to the singer ahead of time. And my buddy tells the story of he did the World Series flyby, excuse me, the Super Bowl flyby in Florida when Billy Joel had the anthem. And, you know, he kind of talks to him the day prior and he's like, hey, Mr. Joel, big fan. Can't wait to hear you sing the national anthem and you know, play it. And he's like, but how long's your national anthem? I don't know.
Here, I don't know.
We knock it out real quick. You can time me. And it was, you know, a minute, 32 seconds or whatever. And so my buddy turns to me. He's like, so can you do that for us tomorrow? Can you hit that exact time? And he's like, oh, yes, sir. So it's you have an interesting conversation with somebody who's, you know, far more famous than you are saying, we really need you to kind of whatever you're going to do. You know, you just kind of need to stay on that schedule because our jets don't have the ability to.
Hold on, let me hit the brakes.
or the song ended. It's like, well, where are the airplanes? Well, they're 15 seconds away. So, yeah, there's a lot of coordination. You have hand signals that go on to the singer, like, hey, I need you to hold the note or go ahead and let's go ahead and wrap it up, you know, kind of thing. So it's a lot of coordination.
Or don't do the minute and a half ending of the national anthem that some people like to do way too often.
Yeah, well, that can save you sometimes if you're running a little bit late. It's like, give me all you got.
I never would have thought about all the complexity behind the scenes, but it makes total sense.
You've driven race cars.
Yeah, but I mean, just like, you know.
It's not quite the exact same thing, is it?
No.
It's still difficult. Don't get me wrong. I mean, driving at the level that you drove, there's still a lot more. Just like you were saying, Steve, when you were weeding people out, right? As they went along through training, it was, okay, we're going to go up. Now we're going to flip this thing over. Now we're going to go up and flip this thing over. And it's like, I can just imagine people get weeded out pretty quick, according to the G's that you're pulling at that time. And you dealt with the same thing in your race car.
Could you imagine how hard it would be to make a flyby if Enrico Palazzo was singing the national anthem? Naked Gun reference for those that are needing to catch up with us.
Just slip into the home.
All right. So, Steve, I got several things I want to unpack with you. But the first thing that I find interesting, which I obviously didn't know until we started having this conversation, I'm fascinated by your clarity. Like, you know, at 17 years old, yep, I'm going to do that. And you got it done. And then as you're in the Air Force, I'm going to go into investing. And now you're a successful investment firm. I mean, I don't know if that's something that can be learned, but I'm really... Is everything in your life like this?
Well, it kind of is for me. And I've had this question before, like, where did you learn this and can you teach it? And it's like, well, I don't know exactly when I learned it. It might be a little bit of the fact that I was an only child. And we lived out in the country. So unlike where I live now, where I have two daughters and they're out doing something all the time, but, you know, kids in the neighborhood, certain, I had a lot of time as a kid to sit and like think. And I actually read books, like who reads books anymore, right? would sit and like really dream and think kind of by myself a lot when I was a younger, when I was a young kid. So I don't know if that's where it came from, but I would have to associate it with that. But I think there are certain people that when you think of a goal, like everybody dreams. So everybody, whether you're young or middle-aged or whatever, you have this idea. And then it's really do you know the process to get from where you are today to that idea? And that's where people, you know, falter or fail or lose confidence or lose that clarity along the way or give up is another one. you know, I've run some marathons and I like to, that resonates with marathon runners is, hey, if you're dumb enough to run 26.2 miles in one day, you know, then you're going to train for it and you're going to do it. And the day of when you're out there doing it, there's a million reasons to quit. There's only one reason to keep going. So you kind of need to hold on to the one reason to keep going. So I think when I talk to young entrepreneurs or business owners, that's what I say is whatever you come up for your goal, you need to break that goal down into something that's achievable. You know, whether it's metrics or like, you know, I'm in the investment business, so it's rate of return and assets under management. So we track those and I update those every day at the end of the day. So the daily, you know, goals are achievable and that all leads to these fantastic long-term goals, which is kind of why I came up with the On Time On Target podcast. Is it's really just no matter what age you are, wherever you're trying to go, you know, let you know how much time you have left. And then are you on target with where you should be financially to meet whatever goal you set for yourself? So that's where I try to help, you know, use my clarity skills, which I don't know where I got them from, but at least help others kind of put them on that same sort of mentality.
Well, I want to go back a little bit, because one of the things that I think is really important for people to understand is we all have dreams. We all have goals. We all have, you know, ambitions. And as long as it's not impossible, right? And what do I mean by impossible? Well, if I said that I would like to be a swimsuit supermodel, well, that's just simply not possible. But there's...
Yeah, you're damn straight.
Thanks, Darren. I appreciate that, bud. I got a podcast with this jerk.
Are you talking about for men or women? Hold on.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. No, either way, it's
still- I'd take either. No, but I seriously, okay, that's like, yeah, that's silly. But if I said, like, I've got a pretty big vision right now. I'm working to build one of the biggest and most respected real estate teams in the Atlanta metro area. Well, I tell people that right now because we're at the foundational level of doing that. And I can tell when I talk to some people about that, they're like, whatever. You know, I don't. There's two forces that'll take you off track from your vision. And I think it's very simple. It's external and it's internal. Either somebody is going to tell you it can't be done or you're going to tell yourself it can't be done. Right. But if you can avoid those two forces, I think whatever it is achievable. And as you said, taking it step by step, because the one thing that I think is really important, and I've had this experience in startups, and I want to get your thoughts on this, Steve, but in finding success in life, whatever that endeavor is, we typically only know what the very next step is. We know where we're going. We can look out to the horizon and say, that's what I want. But I'll be damned if I know how to get there, except for this very, I know if I do this next thing, it gets me closer. Then I get right there and say, okay, now what?
Yeah, I think so. There's, you know, if the end goal is clear, then that does help you know what each step along the way is going to take you. And there's going to be failures along the way. When I speak, I tend to, you know, have to come back and say, it sounds like I've had an easy life and that everything is lined up and very successful. I've had plenty of failures along the way. Normally don't go on a podcast and share all those, but for every step along that journey, there's a point where you're going to go for a goal. And then finally you say, okay, it just can't happen. And then you're going to pivot to something else. I talked about that quite a bit during this COVID-19 period back in March. It's like, you know, people are like, woe is me. And everybody, there are several people that were, you know, financially affected. Some were devastated. And it's this is not the time to get into a rut. This is the time to pivot. It could end up being the best thing that ever happened to you.
Right.
You know, it shook you out of your normal.
Sure.
And pivot and go off into something else. But I would agree with your comments about the internal and external voices. And when I talk about, you know, I'm talking to entrepreneurs and they want to start asking me a question. If it sets up perfectly, I love doing this with folks. And they'll be like, hey, Steve, you know, I'm thinking about doing this, blah, blah. And they start in with their story and I just cut them off and say, you know what? There's no way you can do that. You don't have the right personality to do that. You should give up on it. And then, of course, that's met with some silence and sometimes quite the shocked look back.
A few tears.
Okay.
But.
I go, that was an academic situation. Meaning, I don't mean that. But I wanted you to hear it as if I did mean it. And if you had one or two reactions when you heard me say that, you either shut down and went, man, that guy's right. I probably shouldn't do this. Which means you just answered your own question. If I can just say something, some random comment out of nowhere from a guy you just met can knock you off your game, it's like, yeah, you probably don't have, you know, what it takes to kind of get through there. But if you were immediately like, oh, this guy didn't even know what he's talking about. It's like, heck with him, you know, okay, he's stupid, you know, move on to the next guy. And I'm like, now you've got what it takes, right? If you're a little bit pissed and a little bit like this guy didn't know what he's talking about, then you do have that self-confidence to be able to actually survive all the naysayers along the way. Like when somebody tells you, you know, if you have a big dream, and I got laughed at a lot, go back to a high school reunion or something. They're like, yeah, I do remember you talking about this. And for, you know, when I talk to schools, you know, I tend to ask athletes, I'm like, who thinks they're going to be a professional athlete? And inevitably a few hands go up and I say, well, the fact that you raised your hand and subjected yourself to some embarrassment and ridicule from your buddies means you do have what it takes. Because you don't care what they think and you're going to do what it takes. So you're well on your way.
You got the cojones.
Yeah. If you won't even raise your hand in front of a group of people, well, probably not going to be starting for the Chiefs. You know,
I just raise my hand for the hell of it. Usually it's just to ask where the bathroom is, but that's,
you didn't say what sport,
right? Anybody want to raise their hand? That's all I heard. I didn't hear the rest of it. So, I do have a question. You just said a little bit ago, you just said you don't like to talk about your failures that often.
Mm-hmm.
On podcasts. How come?
I don't like to get into the details. It's the important part is for people to know that you're going to have failures along the way. So when I listen to others speak and you're only hearing the 10 most amazing things to do, people don't tend to own up that, you know, not every day is going to be a good day. There's actually going to be some really bad days where you had your heart set on something and it didn't happen. Most recently, last year, December, I wanted to put on this big military ball for a local retirement community, put a lot of time and effort into it, about $5,000 of my own money into it, and ended up having to cancel it because I couldn't get the tickets sold. So, you know, that's an example. Just realize that stuff is going to happen along the way, even though all you really hear are the good stories, right? You know, this work. It doesn't talk about all the things that didn't work along the way.
Yeah, this is a big topic on this podcast that we've discussed over the past couple of years, because one of the things that I think is important, I don't like to dwell on failure. But what I do like to do is talk openly about the fact that it happens.
Right.
Because I think one of the things that people struggle with, the folks that I worry about, Steve, I'm glad you said this. because it's really kind of opened my mind to something that I've not yet verbalized. That person that gets pissed off when you tell them you're not going to be successful, I'm not too worried about that person.
Right.
They've got what it takes, because that to me is more motivating than anything when somebody's like, oh, well, that can't be done. Like, oh, really?
Watch this.
Watch this shit.
I'm going to build a colony on Mars. Oh, okay.
So that inherently motivates me. But one of the things that I really like to do is I like to take people that are close and move them into that space. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think is really critical is a lot of times people that might have tons of potential but haven't yet got that inner fire, that inner confidence to push, they see people that have been successful and they think, I'm so much different than that person. But in reality, we've all been kicked in the teeth. Mm-hmm. We've all had those days where we're like, holy shit, this is not good. What am I doing?
Right.
But we pick ourselves back up and we keep moving. The important thing is to keep going and to keep trying and not lose sight of that vision that you have. Where am I going? Even though I don't know the whole path to get there, I'm going to keep taking that next step. But I think it's important to connect with people to say, hey, look, it's okay. You're going to have bad days. You're going to have that time when everything goes wrong, especially as an entrepreneur. Holy crap.
Hell.
You want to get kicked in the face? Start a business.
Or you're in the Air Force and you get transferred out to the middle of the desert and you're like, oh gosh, life is going to suck for the next few. Oh
hey, babe.
Your wife. There you
What's
she
up?
Is. Boom. So.
But I really appreciate you verbalizing that, because I think that we have an opportunity with entrepreneurs to connect with them about failure, not to dwell on it, but to say, hey, this is going to happen. And it doesn't mean you are going to fail.
Right.
But it doesn't mean you are a failure. You're going to have great ideas that turn out to be shit.
I used to do
Move
the same
on.
Thing.
Right.
I would do restaurant consulting for that in bars, and they'd be like, oh, I want to open up. I'm thinking about this. And I would start asking them questions that were just nobody had asked them those questions, and looking at their face, and some of them get pissed. And I'm like, if you want to hire me, this is what we're going to go through, but I need to know these things now. Mm-hmm. And if you can't ask them, pretty much you're setting yourself up for failure.
Right.
And so, but they would. Some people would get mad, some people wouldn't. But I like that, Steve. I really do. Like, throw them off their game a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting.
Because I would just tell you in a nice, polite way that you should just go dig a hole somewhere. without cussing or swearing. But I'd be like,
all right. I would have stood up and said, frig off.
Right.
I know what I'm going to do, and go running out of the room with your arms slumped at your sides. You can't tell me what to do.
I'm telling my mom. That's what Aaron would have said.
I had some interesting responses to that. And then I do close while everybody's a little shocked after, like, everybody's paying attention when you say something like that, by the way, in case somebody wasn't paying attention prior.
Oh, now they are. Yeah.
Now they are. But I do kind of wrap it up with them to go back to a positive. Then the one thing is, you really only need to get rich once. So when you think, assuming you're not an idiot.
Hold on. Wait, that's a pretty brilliant fucking quote.
He read it in a fortune cookie is where he got it from.
I'm gonna use that because I got rich. What? It was Bigly.
Yeah, but you kept filing for bankruptcy too. So.
That's awesome. That's a great quote.
Yeah. So all of your failed ideas, it's like, so the first 10 fail, the 11th, if you get rich on the 11th one, well then, it goes into money management a little bit, and kind of like, pro athletes and things, that they get a lot of money, and some of them are very good at keeping it to where that's kind of a lifetime income they have, and then others are not, right?
Most of them are not.
Oh, boy.
If you get rich once by taking a lot of risk, you generally have to have somebody else manage your money, because you are the type that would just continue taking risk and risk and risk till the end of time because you were successful that one time.
God, so, man, that is really insightful.
Yeah.
To tying it back to my background with flying fighters, you can run into what's called a Superman complex. You've gone through what I call the 10,000 hurdles. You're finally there at your goal. You're flying the top, pieces of military equipment, fighter jets that this company, this country has. And at that point, though, for the ejection decision, of course, they're all, the fighter jets have ejection seats. And if things work against you, whether you're shot by another airplane or the airplane has a malfunction or whatever it is, there is a point where you have to give up and save yourself. And if you look back at the history of fighter pots, there has been a real problem with folks trying so hard to save the airplane.
They fly it into the ground.
Yeah, they get all the way, or they get out of the ejection envelope and end up dying with a very late ejection. Yeah. So that's something to talk to them about. It's like, just because you've got everything going for you. Yes, congrats. But don't let that get out of control. And, so same thing with a business. Once you're successful, that's the time to really try to lock down that initial success. Somebody out there, I can't remember who said, the first million's the hardest. Well, yeah, and I would agree. But just because you can make a million doesn't mean you can turn around and do that over and over. So you really do have to protect some of it along the way.
You know what? I have a friend who I was a business partner with for a while, but I've known him for a long time. And he told me, he sat down with me one time before we were getting ready to invest in a business together. And he said, I want to share something with you. He said, the first million is really hard. He said, if you're smart and trust other people with your strategy, the next 20 come easy. And I'm like, oh, you've got 20 million. I'm like, why am I investing so much?
Because he's a smart investor.
Can you spot me a little bit?
All of a sudden you look at your term sheets and you're like,
wait a minute, we're equal?
Hell, I put in twice as much money and he's got twice as much equity. How the hell did that happen?
Damn it. Can I get a loan?
He paid for a better lawyer.
I know.
To write the contract.
But I want to go back. That two things that are so insightful. First of all, you only need to get rich once. I freaking love that because
you got
to
manage it. Keep going.
No. So yeah. a few weeks ago, a month ago, I don't know, I've lost count, but we talked to Glenn Gould, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Glenn had talked about how he had had failure after failure, as an entrepreneur.
Yes, he did.
Openly talking about it on the show, talking about how he got fired.
It worked out really well.
Yeah, I know. But he's now running this flourishing business and he's got you only have to get it right one time and he's got a great business. And, when I sit there and watch him talk, he's got command of it. And, he's just, I'm really impressed with what he's done. And how many entrepreneurs have we talked to that have, Darren, they've hit failure after failure after failure. And then finally something comes together and nobody remembers you for all the shit that went wrong. They're like, Oh, well, he owns such and such.
I don't know. When I hit my first million, people will still go, he's an asshole.
Well, you got to pay the asshole tax. That's going to keep
it. But he was a nice one.
Nice asshole. But seriously, how many entrepreneurs have we talked to that have had that same experience where it's failure after failure?
And then
the one thing hits, and that's all that matters.
It's the one thing that hits, and it doesn't have to be $1 million. You finally hit your stride and you hit that niche, that comfort spot that you've been striving for.
Well, I actually heard somebody interested to hear your thoughts on this, Steve. I heard somebody say, what is rich? Well, rich is when you're no longer working for money and money's working for you.
There you go.
All right. I like that. I tend to.
No, he doesn't. Not all the way. His voice.
You need more money.
But.
You need billions and billions.
And see what you think. Because I think there's two levels. What I use as rich is when you don't have to worry about money, and then wealthy is when you don't have to worry about money ever again.
Oh,
meaning you can be rich if you have a $200,000 job and you've lived within your means and you've maxed out your 401k since you were 25. I mean, you can be rich, but the comma after rich is what happens if you get disabled today? And that's an unlikely scenario. And I don't sell insurance or anything like that. So we're just saying, what if the random scenario happens? If you're rich, then you have a problem on your hands. If you're wealthy, you don't. So it's you're wealthy when you could literally quit your job or just sell your company and go do whatever you want for the rest of your life. That to me is wealthy. So kind of a defining when you don't have to worry about money or don't have to worry about it ever again.
I'm wealthy. Jake told me I could come live on the farm in a tent. So I don't have to worry about anything ever again. I guess I'm good.
It is different levels for different people.
In a van down by the river?
In a van down. Yeah, but we're not allowed to get close to that pond.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I like yours too.
I like that much better.
Yes. I want to be wealthy. I'm not wealthy yet, but I want to be. I'm working on it.
You get there faster if you just get the kids out of the house quicker. Man, they are such a money suck.
Oh, God, those little bastards. No, but you said, so you said two things, Steve, that I thought were really interesting. You know, so the first one was, you know, talking about how you only have to get rich once, which is a really insightful comment. But the other one was you were talking about, you know, if you're somebody that's, you know, not risk adverse and you're, you take risks and that's how you got wealthy. Now you need somebody else to manage your wealth for you because you are prone to taking risk. And I never thought about it that way, but that's actually really sage, really wise advice.
Thank you. When I talk to folks that are in that situation, I tend to lead in with if they've got say $3 million right now and still have this and you know, haven't sold the business or anything. So, you know, there's more coming later likely. But you know, they're kind of at that point and say, what would be the minimum number you could handle your portfolio dropping to? And then you figure that out and you say, okay, that's the fence. That's it. You can take risk as long as it's above that. But if we hit that level, then that is safe money. And people that are risk takers absolutely hate that. The idea of just a whole bunch of money they're sitting doing nothing just as a safety net because they're used to operating without a net. You know, so it is really a different mentality, but you know, that's the sort of mentality also that would get you in trouble. And that's how, you know, I think it was Charlie Sheen that, you know, he was squawking somewhere about he was down to his last 10 million and, you know,
his last 10 million.
He felt destitute. Remember when he was the thing, right? He had his hashtag winning and he was doing all kinds of interesting things. I mean, very fun to follow. But you're like, that's not good. That's not going to end well.
It didn't start well.
But yeah, it's a, you know, whatever that minimum is, you need to make sure you don't, you know, give that back to, right? So in the ups and downs in life, you need to certainly have a safety net out there once you've made it, is what I say.
So we've all sat with a financial planner before, and they give you that wonderful little questionnaire, right, that you go through. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? So they can figure out how risk adverse you are. And then they gauge something else based on the age of your life and your income. And what do you want? What age do you want to retire at? How much do you want to be earning each year or have an income of to be able to do what you do? Do you take people through that same process or do you kind of go about it a different way?
It depends on where they are. I kind of say people are in three phases. There's the haven't started yet, but need to. And those are the folks that say, hey, Steve, I've got, you know, 50K in the bank. Or
yeah, that's 90% of the population, though.
Oh, it's much higher than that.
At least.
For whatever reason. And that's okay. You know, it's who they are. But when they're ready to come off the sidelines, they need to transition in and kind of just get started. So that's kind of one group of people that's out there. That's the haven't started yet. The next set is the trying to get rich folks that are generally still employed, still maxing out 401ks or trying to. Maybe they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 kids at home, which, as we said before, is very expensive. And they're trying to get through that and then trying to get through colleges and weddings. And, you know, there's always the demand for your dollars. But there's getting rich folks. Those are the ones that I need to take through the process that you're talking about. And it's a little bit boring. I tend to lead with it a little more exciting stuff than necessarily sitting down with spreadsheets. It's like I can do all that kind of behind the scenes. But the you know, the folks that are kind of at that rich point, you know, they whether they're entrepreneur and they've made it or they're a 401k, you know, we have Dell computers here in Round Rock, Texas, and we call them Dellionaires, because if you just max out your 401k for 25 years working for Dell, you're going to be a millionaire. You know, kind of the already rich folks, then it's just one question is, what are you trying to do with your money? And I've found that very few people have ever even thought about that. You know, okay, you're rich, you're financially independent now. You know, you live within your means. You don't ever want to have a house in the Hamptons or, you know, they're not trying to buy a private jet or anything. They're just, you know, your upper middle class folks that are just plenty happy with that lifestyle. Right. It's like, what are you trying to do? Do you want to turn your $4 million into $12 million? Or are you trying to support a charity? I know, what's your goal? And that's, I love those conversations a lot more than the spreadsheets of here's what you need to, you know, save each month to get where you want to go.
So, Steve, I have a question for you related to this, because our audience is mainly entrepreneurs. We know this from all of the interaction we get from them. And, you know, it's kind of what we tailor our content towards.
Do we?
Right? We do.
Yeah. I guess.
Are you even here?
Huh?
Yeah, he's really sucking these beers down.
Yeah, I'm on my second, but I'm getting ready to go to a Feist beer in a minute, and we'll talk about that later.
But Steve, here's my question for you. So many entrepreneurs that we meet, and Darren and I know a lot of entrepreneurs we've met through this podcast. Darren's got a co-working space, so he comes in contact with entrepreneurs all the time. We go to a lot of events. Darren hosts 1 Million Cups. So we see a lot of people in this category. And one trait that I think is very common among them is so many people that get into business and find themselves successful, they roll the dice and many times gamble everything, which means, you know, it's somebody in their 30s or 40s, they decided to start a business, and all that savings that they had, they squirreled it away, and then they freaking put it on the line, put their house up, started a business, and all of a sudden the business is now successful. But they've wiped everything out. They've got no savings.
Right.
So is it ever too late for somebody to get the right strategy for investment?
Well, I loved your question up until the right strategy for investment. And here's what I think your listeners will benefit from tremendously is there's the book answer. And what I found is, you know, the book answer is kind of like the common person that like McDonald's seats are designed for, like none exist, right? Everybody's uncomfortable in them to some extent. You know, from a retirement perspective, it is different for everybody. I have, you know, what I'm willing to do, because I think I have a little better appreciation for everything that goes into it with my experiences, I have advised people to cash out their IRAs to start a business. That is like sacrilege in the field of financial planning.
I did it.
And it's just like, well, now hold on. And so here's directly the entrepreneurs out there. Well, one of two things: figure out whether you're an entrepreneur or you want to be a small business owner. And if you haven't thought through that, you need to figure that out.
Ooh,
entrepreneur or a small business owner.
That's a spicy question.
Right. So let's dig into that. With entrepreneurs, start more than one business, and they start them with the intent to sell them. A small business owner starts a venture and may or may not ever be interested in selling it. It's not even on your mind, right? You want to build something and run that business for a while. And you may sell it eventually, but it's certainly not, I'm going to get this thing up to a certain level to where I can sell it and then do something again. So when people think like that, you want to, if it's a small business owner where you're building something slowly over time, then you kind of want to keep your retirement accounts really in place and kind of do it what you will the old school way. Try to bootstrap what you can and, you know, go at it slowly and keep the safety net in place. If you're going to live the entrepreneur dream, you are going to have to be able to get your hands on money. And it's going to be yours first before you can talk somebody else out of theirs. So, you know, if you walk in and pitch me on something and I'm like, well, how much money do you have behind it? And I get anything other than an amount, then it's you don't have any skin in the game. It's like, I'm not going to enter a business with you if you don't have skin in the game, and nor will many of the other players that are out there. So it depends. If you've worked for a company for a number of years and you can't take it and you think you want to be an entrepreneur, that's, you know, a risk you're taking. And that's why I like having that conversation and kind of challenging their assumptions. And, you know, earlier when I said, you know, if I can talk you out of your game by just a random sentence, then you probably shouldn't do it. It's kind of like, and since you mentioned you're a pilot there, Jake, some folks aren't meant to fly, and we're actually doing them a favor by letting them know that up front instead of lying to them and saying everybody can do it. And then they go get into an airplane and then they crash and kill themselves.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't do anybody a favor there, right? So if somebody's, you know, in their 30s or 40s and they're thinking about going down the entrepreneur or the small business path and they have a family, you know, there's a lot of things to think about there on, okay, let's assume it goes wrong. And where, you know, what have you done at that point? And do you still have a family that's going to stick around for that sort of maneuver? So there's a lot of things to think about there. For an entrepreneur, it got long winded there, but for an entrepreneur, the best rate of return you can ever have is betting on yourself. If you're an aggressive investor in the market, maybe you can make 20-25% a year, and that's if you're really good. Kind of your standard, market return is that 10-12% over decades. But if you want to try to make, 100% a year, then you have to get out there and do it yourself, and build a team and get on it. So that's always going to be your best rate of return, not money into the market.
You know, it's interesting that you're saying this, because I actually really, really appreciate your thought process when it comes to entrepreneurism and how to think about money in that sense. Whether you are taking an IRA or just cash that's under the mattress, or you're putting your house up, whatever it is, any business you're going to start, somebody is going to be out there telling you, this is not smart. You know, you're going to take $100,000 and start a restaurant. You're going to take $50,000 and do this. You're going to put a second mortgage on your house to do, whatever.
Open up a roofing company with
$2,000. Insert idea here.
Hold on.
Right. Insert idea here. Whatever it is, there are going to be people that line up and tell you, that's stupid. That's crazy.
Well, John probably would. I mean, John is not an entrepreneur. He doesn't have that mindset. John is, let me go get my job, punch the clock. I wish you were here today, John. But, he's that type of person who would be like,
But he's also a guy that understands risk and reward. And he's taken financial risk on the investing side. So sure. I'd say he gets it.
But not stepping out and doing a business.
Because it's fucking crazy. That's the problem.
Well, we are fucking crazy because we do it.
But this is.
But I think what separates it is that difference. I like what he said when he said the difference between a small business owner and an entrepreneur. Now, didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No. And I think that's where I'm coming to. So, Steve, what I really like about your comments there is, anytime you're going to take a risk for a business, some people will line up and tell you that's crazy. But going back to what you said initially, if you really believe that you can make this happen, you've got the vision, don't let people talk you out of it. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you're risking 10 grand, 100 grand, or a million. If you believe that you can make that business successful, this is where wealth, real wealth, has come from time after time. Somebody that's willing to say, you know what, I got an idea and I'm going to do this. And you look back on how many people have we met that have built amazing businesses here? That it started with them putting every freaking thing they had, including the house, including the savings, putting it all up and saying, I believe in this and I'm willing to bet everything I have on it.
I do, but I also, now I'm thinking when Steve said that one comment about being a small business owner or an entrepreneur, because an entrepreneur is building something to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of all the people that we've interviewed and I'm like, are they a small business owner or are they a entrepreneur?
I think some of them are small business owners that don't yet know they're entrepreneurs,
but
because they don't realize that they've got something.
Entrepreneurs are people, I guess, as we would classify it, as most people do, are somebody who is willing to take a risk to jump out and do something and call it their own and make a business, turn it into a business or become a business, open a business, whatever it might be. And at one point, we still take risks every day. Even the people who own businesses that I would maybe now classify as small business owners because they want to do it, you're doing it for yourself. I mean, that's a lot of it. I can do it better than where I was before, or I had this idea, and that's why I've opened my business.
Well, let's use an example. So the first person that came to my mind, I don't know why, was Nick Brannon from Hero Roofing.
That's just crazy.
Steve, if you didn't hear his interview, so he used to work for a roofing company and realized that there was so much stuff that they did wrong. He's like, I can do this better. So he and his father decided to start a company. They took $2,000, started this company, and their first year had $1 million in revenue. And these guys are slaying it. And that was their goal. And they're slaying it. They are growing like crazy. And I would classify Nick as a small business owner because it's the only business he's ever started. Mm-hmm. He came from something that he knew because he worked in the roofing industry, but he figured out a way to do it better than everybody else. I think what he doesn't realize is that at some point, because there are a couple years in business, in 5 years, 10 years, he's going to have something unbelievable that he could sell and create tremendous wealth for himself.
Right.
Yeah. And he doesn't know it yet.
He's an unknown entrepreneur.
Right. You only need to get rich once.
That's, yeah.
I got news right? for you.
When I talk to folks, you know, pick an advisor, CPA, or somebody that's out there on their own, it's just like, what's your end game? And they're like, well, I want to do this till I'm, you know, 65 or 70, or till they're financially independent. You know, they have some fence, and I'm like, okay, well, what's your plan for selling it? And then they're like, well, I'll just stop doing it, and my clients will go find, you know, other people. I'm like, you've built an entire business. You have a book. That book has value for somebody who does what you do. And you can simply call up, you know, 10 people and say, hey, I've got 50 clients that are normally used to go under me. I want to take care of them. I'm interested in selling my book of business. Are you a buyer? And, you know, there's a whole chunk of money out there of value that you built over time that you need to capitalize on. And a lot of folks just don't even think about that until you bring it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, you know, we actually had an episode of the podcast where we had a business broker on, and we actually talked about this very thing, because I think a lot of times people think about selling their business when it's too late. It's like, well, I want to retire in a couple of years. I really need to think about selling this. It's like, man, the strategies for building value probably should have started 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, maybe I should have kept cleaner books.
maybe I should have used GAAP accounting. Yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but my friend told me, I like my accountant. He's, well, we had him on the podcasting.
Yeah.
We actually had a conversation yesterday, and he's like, if this happens and this happens, here's something that you can do, and it's great for all around. I'm like, oh, thank God I have Justin.
Yes.
Anyway, but I want to digress really quick, because in...
Oh, Jesus, it's Darren.
No.
Buckle your seatbelt.
If we're not going there, that's fine. We can skip over it. But there's a big... You were talking about the three different stages of people that you work with, you know, three different groups of people. And that middle one is a huge market. And whether you're a business owner, whether you are an employee, but by the time somebody actually decides to start saving for retirement, right, investing in their retirement, and as you said, their 401k, they might be, if the light bulb comes on, they're going to be in their mid-30s. So they've already wasted 15 years, 17 years of time that they should have been, as people put it, the magic of compound interest.
The eighth wonder of the world.
Right. But, you know, you get them at 35 and you're like, oh, when do you want to retire? And of course, they're like, well, I want to retire at, you know, sooner than 65. And it's like, you might want to push that back to 75. But just between a 401k, which you can only contribute, what is it right now, 16.5 a year?
It's up to 19.5 now.
19? But even if you have a two household income, that's only 38,000. If you're fortunate enough to have a company that's going to do a match at 50%, 38, so now we're at 57, you know, in 30 years, you might have $1.5 million if you're lucky, or by the time you hit 65 and hoping to retire by then without compound interest and everything else, that's still not, I mean, $1.5 million at 65 to last you the rest of your life. As you said, it's wealth, right? When you're wealthy, what if something major hits at that point? So yeah. how do you help people, like, instead of just staying in that norm, that channel of, I get my 401k and this is going to happen, and then my Social Security is going to kick in. And it's like, well, do you want to travel? Do you want to go see your grandkids or your children or be able to do these other things? It's a bigger umbrella. How do you take them, like, gently move them away from that norm that they expect to maybe trying some other investment opportunities that are out there?
Well, I would have to say that use gently, and I'm generally the guy that is you're not going to go to for the gentle truth, if you will.
Didn't expect that, Steve.
Not at all.
No, that's cool.
He's going to show up in his flight suit.
Me, but,
but give me $50.
When I do talk to folks about that, I generally, you know, it's how this is all going to play out. And you're right. $1.5 million for some people, they hear that and they're like, that's all I would ever need. And for them, that's true. And if you're staying on the farm at Jake's house or whatever the analogy was earlier, that's probably fairly cheap. if you're sleeping with the pigs out there.
I can assure you, he's got a fifth wheel in the back. That's why I'm not really concerned about it.
Yeah, but we need to talk about Darren's whiskey budget, which is pretty high.
So there's things that you're going to either you're going to tailor your retirement down to your means, which is called reality. I mean, that's just what's going to happen. If your money starts to run out. But what happens is for the folks that start late and that you can't get them to take more risk or put more money away is there's kind of three phases of retirement. If you've heard this before, there's the go-go phase where you retire and, you know, you tell off your boss or you sell your company and you go do whatever you want with your spouse if you have one. And that's the go-go phase. Then you have the slow-go phase where you just kind of don't feel like doing as much. And then there's the no-go phase where you're generally sedentary, very happy and content. Your family's now coming to see you sort of thing. But what happens if folks get a late start and don't take enough risk or don't put enough money away is they end up working through the go-go phase. And those are the golden years that everybody's talking about is when I have now money to go out and travel and do all the things I wanted to do. You're going to end up working through that phase. And that's kind of the tragedy that they're facing. So I want to be kind of blunt with that's kind of the path you're on. And then, of course, reverse engineer that too. So to not be on that path, you're going to have to, basically really kind of hunker down now. I call it adulting with some folks, depending on their, if they can handle that term. It's like, now's the time to adult. You really need to get on it to be able to have a good retirement that you're looking forward to.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I got a couple of questions for you. First of all, so I was one of those that my parents never talked to me about finance, right? And I was smart enough that when I got my first real job, I started to contribute to a 401k just because I thought, well, I should probably do that. And I don't need all of my paychecks. So I'll just start pumping money in there. And if I don't see it, it won't hurt. So I was lucky that I did that because I started to create savings early. And I know so many people because I got into management at the same company later on, and I would meet people, people going into management, and I would talk to them about finance. It's like, okay, you're moving into management. Right. Talk to me about what are you doing with your 401k? Are you investing aggressively because we're matching? So I talk about what the company's doing. You know how many people I'd meet in their 30s that didn't have a dime saved?
Yeah, that's free money that you're getting when the company matches. Two is the misnomer that you just said that my paycheck is going to be less. And the gap actually isn't as much.
It's not a one for one, right? Because it's
not at all. Because what you're investing, actually, once you take that out, you could invest, put in $100, $200 a month, and that only really affects your paycheck by like $25 at the end of the year based on the tax differences. And that's one of the misconceptions that people have. Correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, please.
Nope, you're right. Ultimately you are basically saving today's dollars to spend it tomorrow. So if you think of your future self, you want to not upset your future self by what you're spending now. And when folks talk about the other way of debt, if you're spending a bunch of money on your credit cards and you end up and you can't pay that off at the end of the month, well, basically all you're doing is pissing off your future self.
Right.
So. When you're down the road, you're going to be mad that you did that. So the same thing with the 401k, you want to do it now. So you're happier down the road that you did it. And you're right. Most people don't feel the pain if you have it taken out automatically. You know, if it goes to the bank and then you have to send it back in, that's a huge expense, right? It's like people are going to stop doing that. But if it's gone and it's a little bit, especially when you get promotions, like going into management, it's the perfect time to go, okay, just put another 100 or two a month away up to the max and then you're good to go.
But Jake's even got the right idea. I mean, he was telling his employees the right thing or the people he was working with moving up in management, but it's pre-tax dollars. So your adjusted income.
Well, let me get to my question. I'm going somewhere with this, right? So here's what I wanted to ask you, Steve, or get you to opine on. So many times, and I'm no different. I thought that by investing in my 401k and I was maxing it out, I was doing really good. I'm fine. I'm going to be totally fine for retirement. And what I didn't realize until later in life, I got into my 30s and I started thinking a little bit more seriously about my future. I realized that, oh shit, that's not going to be enough money. I'm not going to be, because my goal was to not ever worry about money at some point in my life. Right. And I realized in my 30s, like, wait, this is not going to be enough. And it took me too long to figure that out. And during that time, I could have been making investments in other places. But I thought, you know, well, this is like my parents' pension, you know. Okay, so I invest in my 401k my whole career, and I'll retire and I won't worry about money. But that's a false narrative, isn't it?
It is. And I think, you know, if you start right at 21, it kind of works out. But who starts right at 21, right?
No, I didn't.
I think in high school, I had the same thing. My parents.
I was doing keg stands at 21, so you know.
When I was in high school, my parents said your job is to get good grades, and I did that. And then one day they said, "Hey, you need to go get a job," and I'm like, "What are you talking about? You told me to get good grades. Here's all my good grades." And they're like, "No, you need to go make some money so we can. You're going to keep the money, but we can match that into your individual retirement account." And I'm like, "So that sounds like free money, right?" So anytime Aaron was saying, you know, free money is free money. So I did and got to my start then, and kind of, you know, that led me to where I am today, because that money's, you know, gone up like 8 times since I put it in it, you know, 8x or whatever. But you're right. For most folks that don't start, you know, super early or don't max out right away, that need to catch up, or most people in their 30s, you're right. You need to max out the 401k. If you're in a relationship, both of you need to do that. If you're both working, you need to max out your IRAs, whether you do traditional or Roth is another conversation. But max that out. Again, it's not a whole lot of money. And then generally the third one is real estate. So you're either putting money into the house you live in, or you're buying a rental property and kind of expanding your portfolio that way. All of those are little, if you picture an airplane with engines on it, each one of those is its own little engine. And of course, the primary engine is your income, because that's you driving that engine. But when you get to retirement, the big engine goes away, because you're not generating the same amount that you were. So you need to get all the other engines spun up to spin big enough where they can carry the airplane to where it needs to go. So that's my flying analogy I use for folks. And you're right. The more of them you have cooking for you, the better off you are.
So I feel like I've led the witness, because the other question that I wanted to ask you, which I think is really, really important. And I think this is a big secret, especially for people that maybe they're in that first category, the three categories you talked about, they've not yet started, and maybe they're later in life. I think one of the biggest, I don't want to call it secrets, but maybe call it a secret. But one of the most interesting ways to get rich is off other people's money, right? Mm-hmm. And with real estate, it's amazing. If you start investing in real estate with the bank's money, especially with rentals, and just let that stuff go over time. And we have a strategy in real estate we call laddering, sure, where mm-hmm. you take equity that you've built mm-hmm. on a rental, and then you cash out that and then get another rental and then let that build off somebody else's money. And then you ladder up and you take that equity and you continue to grow. There's no secret why so many billionaires have invested in real estate. You know, there's a strong correlation there.
Have you seen my the Taj Mahal?
It's Trump Towers.
Mar-a-Lago.
It's Bar-a-Lago is how I say it. But it's amazing that that's available for everybody, assuming you've got decent credit. But I don't hear enough financial strategists say what you just said, which is, you know, rental properties, real estate. There's a way to make money in real estate with somebody else's cash. Why not do that as a part of your portfolio?
I will tell you that I will rant on my own profession, which is largely one of the reasons I went into it and am different, is because most financial advisors are paid on either a flat fee or an assets under management thing. And if you're advising somebody to do the right thing, which may be go into real estate or even, you know, laddering using leverage, they aren't getting compensated for that. So therefore, there's a tendency for financial advisors to say you have to put everything in the stock market.
Yep.
And other advisors out there, like when entrepreneurs talk to a financial advisor, the conversation lasts like 5 seconds because they don't speak the same language.
Right.
Advisors are spreadsheets and safety nets and no, you know, moderate risk. And an entrepreneur is like, no, what's going to happen when I sell my company for several million, you know, 10 years from now? So talking different languages, but they're using leverage in real estate, I think, is a brilliant thing to do. And a lot of people say debt. And so when a client comes to me and says, hey, I'm maxing everything out and I want to put my next dollars towards something. And they say, I think I should pay down my house. And I'll say, generally, my first answer is a little bit snarky, is I will say, well, you can do that if you want to delay your financial goals.
And what
did he say? He talks so fast. What did he just say? He
said, but that's not what Dave Ramsey said.
Oh, I'm God. Like,
Now, if interest rates, I was born in 69, I'm 51. So, I mean, I saw high interest rates. I bought my first house at a 7% mortgage. And yeah, you did. Of course, I grew up with that of you need, you know, beat your children over the head with, hey, when you buy a house, see how you know, you're not paying rent and then pay it off as fast as you can. But okay. But if you stop to think about it, it really depends on the interest rate, which is really a deeper mathematical concept, because a lot of people think if you owe somebody money, that's debt, and debt is bad, which obviously Dave Ramsey and several others carry that torch. Just like you said, Jake, is, well, if you stop using the word debt and start using the term leverage, then if you use it as leverage and as a tool, then you can get into other properties. You know, it's the same thing as I pay, you know, up to 20% of the money and the bank funds the rest. It's not a bad deal. I don't want to tie up a bunch of money into a house if I only have to put 20% in it. There's risk there. You need to know what you're doing. But mathematically, you'd be better off doing that for a wealth building venture over time. But not a lot of advisors talk about that. You're right.
Can we use the word working capital? Is that a nicer way to put it?
Well, you know what? I want to stop here because this is actually very interesting that you're saying this, Steve, because in our business, I ask people all the time if they've ever thought about investing with leverage. And I'm telling you, well over 9 out of 10 people have no idea what
they
I'm
don't
talking
know what
about.
You're talking about.
Right. No. And it's like, what is leverage? It's like, well, leverage is using somebody else's money to get rich. Mm. And all of a sudden they're like, excuse me, how does that work?
Right.
You know,
yeah. and it is a beautiful thing. And so in it's interesting, so many people think debt is bad, but if debt is right. leverage for building wealth, it's phenomenal. Money is an instrument.
Well, it is.
It depends on how you use it, right?
Let me ask you a quick question.
Yes,
because
sir.
We interviewed somebody earlier on a different episode, the previous episode, and you know, LaMarcus, and we were talking about it, investing in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The return on that is a 5X on your money in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Would you want a 5X return on your investment within 2 years?
No, because I'm an idiot.
Well,
I would.
Actually, that's for Steve. He hasn't heard this part yet. I mean, would you, if you could get a 5x return on your investment within 2 years, would you take it, Steve?
Sure. It was guaranteed.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a silly question.
Well, I'm just asking.
But what we're getting at is what I would call non-traditional investments.
Right.
It's not on the market.
Right.
But one of the things I'm going to go back to,
you,
Steve.
Though, Jake, every day of my life, I'd invest in you.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Just to bring me.
How drunk are you?
I just need you to bring me my beer. That's it. That's what I invest in you. But you're going to pick up the beer and bring it to the podcast.
Well, that's good. So Steve, I there's one thing though that I definitely want to go back and point out. Earlier you stated that if somebody was an entrepreneur that you would say, yeah, it's worth your while to cash in an IRA to go for it, to take that swing. I don't think I've ever heard another financial planner say something like that.
No.
Because the problem, and I say it's a problem because it's not always the best strategy, but I think the problem with your industry, and I'm going to group you with the industry of financial planners, mm-hmm. is they're typically their only motivation is to manage your wealth, right. meaning I want your IRA to be in my portfolio, so I need your money. And sometimes the best strategy for somebody is to spend that money elsewhere and not have the financial planner manage it in their quote unquote portfolio.
But
yeah. Keep going.
What if I turned around and made 10 times that by cashing that out? And then I come.
No, that's my whole point.
Yeah.
And what I find, and I'm saying this because I find it unbelievably refreshing, Steve, to hear you talking about this, and I'm sure you're talking to your clients and you're talking on, and I'm really interested to start tuning into your podcast and learn a little bit more. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's so refreshing to hear a financial planner, a wealth builder, talking about things that 99% of other financial planners aren't talking about.
Right. And I think it's, we as an industry don't really do our clients justice, because we tend to picture everybody as the 1990s college graduate that you go, work in a job and a profession, make six figures, everybody seems the same in the financial world, and everybody's really different. So, I think the financial world kind of in the 80s kind of ran them up for a while, and we started having mutual funds, and then mutual funds that are, portfolio. There was actually a business called the Mutual Fund Store. And they put my parents into like 50 different mutual funds. So it's like, okay, cool. Like 51 people are reaching into your pie and taking a little sliver of it. That's awesome. They took a good idea of diversification in one instrument and then tacked on a bunch of fees and then oversold the crap out of it. So now it's like when I do individual stocks for clients, if they're up for it. And as soon as I say, what I like to do is crack open a mutual fund, take the top 10 holdings and put that in your portfolio. You just erase a ton of drag off your airplane, using the flying analogy, that you never pay again. It costs nothing to buy a stock now. It'll cost nothing to sell the stock later. So literally, it's as frictionless as you possibly can get for investing. And I start talking about that at conferences, and people look at me like, wow, that's just weird. And that's, of course, why I'm wearing a flight suit. It's because, I understand risk. I have flown in combat. I understand all of the math behind this. And most of the financial industry has been, honestly, I tend to ask other folks, I'm like, ask your financial advisor what their plan is. Do they love their job or hate their job? And, what their plan is. And most of them are like, my guy can't wait to retire. I'm like, and you have that person in charge of your future? You don't even like what they do. They're not like even passionate about it. So it's kind of crazy with what the industry's done out there. And when I talk to, entrepreneurs, and I'm at a networking thing, and I say I'm a financial advisor, it's almost like they turn and walk away. So we have nothing in common. And
so let me share something with you, because you just mentioned mutual funds, and I'm going to jump on my soapbox for a minute. So mutual funds, what you hear from people in the financial community, I'm going to be interested to hear your thoughts on this, is like, it's a sure bet, it's a low risk thing, and blah, blah, blah. This is personal experience. In 2008, when the market crashed, I was in my 401k pretty heavy at AT&T, and I suffered a tremendous loss. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
No shit.
Yeah, I'm like, dude, my 401k went to like 30% of its value. And I'm like, what the hell is happening? Well, what happened was I'm not going to name the name of the 401k, but it's very, very big.
Okay. Fidelity what?
I'm not going to name the name, starts even if it starts with an F. And we only had various funds that we could invest in. Well, I put my safe money in this mutual fund. Okay. This mutual fund was 90% invested in GM bonds.
Navigator what?
Remember what happened to GM?
Yeah.
In the bankruptcy? And the bondholders got fucked. And it went to almost zero. So the least, it's so stupid. The least risky part of my 401k went to almost zero, while everything else was like, everything was getting hurt. But I'm like, oh my God, that's the most pain I felt. And if that was supposed to be the safe one.
Right.
Yeah, that hurt.
Big time.
Still haven't fully recovered from that. I'm butthurt over that.
Well, I like Steve's philosophy. I mean, what do they say? If you love something, let it go, and something, and it'll come back to you. So what he's saying is, I think you should take a risk. Go ahead and cash this out. I won't be able to manage it for a while, but you go out there. I believe in you. I believe in what you're doing with your business. You're going to make a shit ton of money. And guess what? You're going to need somebody. You're going to need to know what to do with it now that you made a lot of money. Now come back to me, and I will help you protect that money and take care of it and really make it grow. So I helped you become rich. Now I'm going to help you become wealthy.
Yeah, I think
is that about right? I mean,
yeah, but that's, again, it's a small sliver of the population, but you have a population listening to this podcast. So please don't just run out and cash out.
don't do it.
Hold on.
Reason.
On
Steve,
fire.
Yeah, Steve told me to just cash out my IRA. I don't know what I'm doing, but I did it. No, but I mean,
I'm going into cold yoga. I really believe in it.
If I have a business idea and I come to you and I'm like, Steve, I need some money. I've got, you know, this business that I want to invest in. And I cash out $50,000. But I know that I'm going to come back and see you in 3 years because I've sold it or whatever. And I come back with $500,000. I'm sure you would rather have my $500,000 portfolio than my $50,000 portfolio to manage.
Well, I would say it's literally not about me whatsoever. It is really about what's best for the client and their family. And I mean that.
It's a smart answer.
Whether they would come back to me or not, I want them to be successful. And I will tell you that my clients do come back to me because I'm upfront and honest with them. So that is not the right move for everybody, but it can be in certain situations.
Sure.
Again, if you can get a loan generally to start a business, that's a better way to kind of manage that risk versus cashing in your future. But if you're at a point where you just need capital to get the thing off the ground and go, well, you can do that. And right now we have the CARES Act in place where you can take your up to $100,000 out of your 401k and you have 3 years to pay it back.
Oh boy.
So, you know, some financial advisors that if they're, you have any that are listening, probably just winced right there. It's like, don't even tell them that. No.
Yeah, but you wear a flight suit, so you're entitled. You got the chutzpah to do it.
You get that correctly. So, you know, that's a high risk move. So you need to be paying attention while you're doing it. But yeah, it is an option for you. There is, you know, you mentioned the movie scenario, and it's funny because I have two Hollywood, they hate when I say Hollywood, I'm supposed to say small independent.
Actually, you should say Georgia.
That
because we're the new Hollywood, just saying.
Wow, there you go. Well, they live outside of Hollywood, and they do independent movies trying to sell, you know, the $1 to $3 million budget movies to all the folks out there. And, you know, they're the same sort of thing, have money investing with them. And you're right, you can make 5X is kind of optimistic, but certainly a 2 to 3X. In a couple of years, you know, a business or each movie opens as its own LLC. It gets funding and it goes through and there's tails. And I mean, it's a legit investment. But then I tell folks that are like, well, you know, I just want to make the most money I can. And so like, well, you can go buy a t-shirt at Walmart for $2 and, you know, print it yourself and sell it for like 15. And that's 7.5 times your money. It's like, is that what you really want to do with your life?
Hold on, say that again. I'm writing it down with crayon so I can.
He heard 7X.
It's a new business plan.
Like 7X. I'm out of movies. I'm into Walmart t-shirts.
Walmart t-shirts.
You're never in the market, and I'm a market guy, but you're never in the market going to make what you can if you take a business from scratch. So sure. When you hear, I wish I could attribute the quote to somebody. But somebody's like, hey, who in here wants to be a billionaire? And, you know, a bunch of hands go up. And it's like, well, first of all, you need to, if you have a job, you have to quit it. If you're in school, you have to quit that. And you need to leave this room right now, because otherwise you're going to run out of time.
Mm.
So the biggest thing, if you want to be a billionaire, the biggest thing you have to do is stop doing everything else and go all in on figuring out how to make a ton of money with your new business, you know, product or service, and turn that into a business and then try to scale it till you're up to a billion.
Time is money.
That's right.
Yeah. A lot of people hear that and they're like, well, okay, maybe I'll do that next year.
But, or you could just collect pennies, right? Because they say if you double every penny that you collect each day, how long does it take you to before you hit a million?
What the fuck are you talking about?
Never heard that. Like if you collect penny
today,
pennies
with this guy
tomorrow, and then exponentially you collect that many pennies each day.
Yeah.
It's
about a month.
How long is it?
About a month. I think it's like 32 days before you have $1 million. It's kind of crazy.
Do you know how?
See, there's validation. It's not a dumbass.
On day 10, I couldn't even carry all the pennies with my Super Duty. It's too much weight. Jesus.
Well, on day 10, I would have stopped because I would have walked by a liquor store. Like,
ooh, whiskey. I've got pennies. I'm a fan. So Steve, we've covered a lot of ground, but I don't think we've even come close to touching what the right financial strategies are. So one of the things I want to happen is I want our listeners to tune into your podcast. So tell us again, what's the name of your podcast?
It's called On Time, On Target. So again, borrowing from, you know, my bomb dropping days in combat, flew the first night of Shock and Awe, dropped the first bomb, went in there alone and unafraid in a stealth fighter, and dropped a couple bombs. Well, when you start dropping bombs anywhere, you have to, everything needs to be able to hit the ground at the exact time, because everything's orchestrated. As far as, airplanes running through, you don't just get to do your own thing. So being on time, on target in combat, and then I take that theme to a financial on time, on target. So whether you're 55 and don't have a dime to your name, well, this is what you should have. This is what you need. Here's what you'll have to do to get there, sort of thing. Or if you're 15 and listening, it's like, how much money, should you have then? Ideally, most people don't have any money at 15. Or less than 1,000 if they're saving birthday money. But here's some ideas of what you can do, and this is how far it'll get you. That's what my podcast helps people with. And it's taken it to the next level. And I hope that's what you've heard today, is that a lot of people go to school for financial planning and then they come out and they say the same thing every day, and there are right and wrong answers. I like to look at it as everybody's different. Try to figure out what you are trying to do with your money, and then you need to figure out what you need to do with your time to develop the skill set to get to that level of money. And what are the fence posts along the way so you know that you're on track? And if you're off track, then what do you need to do to fix it? So that's the idea of the podcast. And I hope that people that listen to it, really, it's more of a thinking piece and an eye opener than it is to a place where you go for specific answers.
Well, I am subscribed, and I challenge all of our audience to subscribe. It's very easy to find. Go and I just tested it. Go into any podcast app.
A reoccurring guest on the show.
Well, I don't think he's going to get you rich by coming on more.
No, but some of our listeners probably could. By the tips that he would.
Yeah.
Even if we had him, like,
listen, man,
so
if you ever have like anything to share with our audience that's a insider tip or something interesting, we'd love to have you back on. This has been really, really interesting.
It. You also have a book out, don't you? Or you have a couple of them, but what's your most recent one?
I do have a couple books out. One is the first one I wrote while I was on active duty. It's about the execution of air power and decentralization, and that's really kind of in the weeds for a bit of a military. If there's any military buffs out there, you would enjoy reading it. You can find that on Amazon.
Yes, please.
And then the second one out there is I wrote as part of a compilation book. I wanted to kind of get my story out of how I got to have the best job in the world, which is flying fighters. So I do write a chapter in a book that's out there called Sharing the Wealth, and the about a 10-page story on, what it was like as a kid and the challenges I had, and then trying to actually get up into becoming a fighter pilot and what that was like.
Awesome.
That is excellent.
And we can find that anywhere books are sold, Amazon. Where do we find that?
Amazon's your best bet.
Amazon. Okay. Of course, Amazon. I hate that I love them so much.
You know what? We need to give a shout out to the person who pointed you in our direction.
Yeah, you were actually connected to us via Tiffany Wicks, who is going to be a guest on the show very soon.
Very soon. That's why I wanted to give a little shout out to her. But she also deserves a thank you as anybody.
Yeah, this has been awesome, Steve. I have been really genuinely impressed with you and surprised by some of the things you've said as a financial planner. You're clearly a guy that gets it. So if I'm listening right now, if I'm one of our subscribers and I'm like, man, my financial planner sucks. How do I contact you?
Reach out through afterburnerfinancial.com.
Afterburner Financial, the baddest ass fucking financial planning name ever.
Except
the worst case is you're going to lose 2 minutes of your life looking at cool airplane pictures. So I mean, there's
awesome.
That's the worst case. So you can reach out to my website and contact me, and I will tell you that if all you're looking for is the standard answer, you go to your local person. I'm more into the more challenging, more entrepreneurial type. The challenges are different, and there's a lot of things to think about. And entrepreneurs really need to be all in on what their product or service and building their business. Just being honest, not trying to, hopefully I've earned enough honesty to say that it's not me pushing my own business. But if you are putting everything in your own hands, then you need to spend 100% of your time on that. You don't need to be worried about what your investments that you have off in your IRAs are doing. Because if you're off spending time managing that, then you're not actually on focusing on your business.
Yep.
If you're trying to scale it, it takes so much time and effort. You really need to be all in on that. So That's who I kind of appeal to, are the small business owners or entrepreneurs or folks that, you know, they've got a sizable 401k, but now they're faced with that. I kind of do want to start, you know, open a bar in Austin. It's like, well, you need to talk to a lot of people before you pull that trigger, right? Just to make sure that the math that you think is going to happen has a realistic chance of happening. So,
well, it's Steve Ankerstar and Afterburner Financial.
A-N-K-E-R-S-T-A-E.
And we'll have that in the show notes. So whatever podcast app you're listening to, you'll be able to look in the notes and see that. Afterburner Financial.
You know what problem I have, though, with this whole thing?
What?
The entire episode, all I could think of is freaking Kelly McGillis in the back of my head from like Top Gun as soon as he said that. And I really don't appreciate that.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
Oh, God.
Well, listen, if you want a badass fighter pilot managing
that's
money,
who Steve's, I want to manage Steve's my money. Guy. Somebody's going to tell me, listen, you know what? As John would say, buck up, you snowflake.
Exactly.
This is your future investing in. So let's do it right. And that's why we got Steve for us.
Yeah, well, congratulations on all your success, Steve, and thanks for coming on the show. And as we've been sitting here talking, Darren and I have crossed over. We're drinking Lime Creek's Fest beer, which we drank this the first time a couple of weeks ago. This is their Oktoberfest offering. It's a German lager. It's not exactly a Marzen, but God dang, this thing's good. It's golden. Fabulous. It's perfect. If you're watching on video, look at that. It's just so pretty. Oh,
damn, it's so good.
It's been a good beer day. It's like a good hair day. It makes you feel really good.
This is a really good beer day.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be calling an Uber after we get done with this podcast.
Well, Steve, we hope you've had a good time and you've had the chance now to talk to the best audience and podcast. So I'm sure everybody is like really thankful for your time. And I hope that you get some people reaching out to you to say, hey, man, I want you to manage my money. I want an American hero to manage my money.
Hillary will let me.
Hey, listen, I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
But I've got
But
some
I do
cash.
Have a relationship with Steve. He's making me rich. Oh, boy.
Steve, thank you. We appreciate it.
I disrespected my thirsty goat by not finishing it. So that just must be a sign I need to come back in one of the future episodes.
Listen, man, we would have you back on the show anytime. This has been awesome.
And the last thing before we go, and we talked about this at the beginning, we may not be releasing this episode today. It may come out a week later, but today is 9/11.
It is. You were in the service, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was in the middle of New Mexico. I was fully trained, combat ready as an F-117 stealth fighter pilot, and I was in chemical warfare training, and I walked in, and that's when I saw it playing on the big screen, and I knew that my life was changed right there, because there's only two squadrons of F-117s, and I knew we were going. We just didn't know when. So I called my boss, called into the op center, and he's like, all the pilots are to go home and get your affairs in order. We could be gone in 24 hours. It turned out we didn't go for 24 hours. We went a little bit of a year later, and we ended up going to Iraq. But that day obviously changed a lot of lives, and mine was one of them. I talk specifically in my first episode of my podcast to a Steve Ankerstar. I tell the story all the way running it back through my 9/11 time, what I was thinking at that time, and then how that ended up turning into combat sorties down the road.
Well, we want to thank you, everybody else who has served, and those who were there on that day.
Yeah, it was, everybody knows exactly where they were. You know, if you were old enough to know what was going on that day, you remember exactly where you were. And one of the biggest things about 9/11 that I think is a positive, uplifting thing that we can end the show on is I remember on 9/12, I never felt more American than I did that day. It was not about us and them. It was not about politics. It was about we, as a country, we were attacked and we will defend ourselves. And, you know, I dream that at some point in my lifetime that I will feel that level of connectedness to my country that I did on 9/12.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have that feeling come back.
It would. Well, Steve, you are an American patriot, a hero, a badass. We really appreciate you coming on. And I look forward to you making many people wealthy, including our listeners and maybe even me.
Hopefully me too.
Well, thank you so much, Steve. It's been a pleasure. Folks, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.